The Oracle Network.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Jules, and this is Riddle Me That True Crime. So today I'm really excited. I've got Kristen from Murder, She Told on the podcast. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm so good. I'm so excited to be here that I just, you know, messed up me saying hi.
It happens. I mess up so many words. They can be hard.
Yes, Words are hard.
Words are hard. So I want to know a little bit more about you. You grew up in Maine, right?
Yes, I did.
So is growing up in Maine like growing up in a Norman Rockwell painting?
Kind of. I mean, it's, don't get me wrong, it's very picturesque, but I feel like there's two sides to the state. There's the coast, which is what everybody pictures when they think of Maine. You know, you automatically think of lobster rolls and like Acadia National Park. But really, the majority of the state is extremely rural. And it's a lot of farmland. It's a lot of forest. You know, Maine is known for its, or at least at one point in time, paper mills and logging and agriculture. So I am from that part of the state. I'm not from the coast or the cute part of Maine. I am from the very rural part of Maine, which, you know, it has its ups and downs, but it can look like a Norman Rockwell painting for sure.
When I think of Maine, and keeping in mind, I'm Canadian and I'm terrible with geography, I literally think of just lobsters and coastal Maine like you described. And again, you on your podcast, you cover small town crime, but you also have a focus on Maine and New England. So for those of us who aren't good at geography, like myself, do Maine and New England kind of butt up against each other?
As far as like conflict between like state, you know,
No. Like, are they right beside each other, like geographically speaking, or?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I was picturing like, you know, the states like going to battle against each other.
Like East Coast, West Coast type of feuds, or North and South.
Kind of. Yes. So Maine is actually the only state that only borders one other state. So it borders Canada and then New Hampshire. And then you have Massachusetts, you have Connecticut, which is also part of like the tri-state area with New York and New Jersey, but those are not part of New England. Just Connecticut is. I already said, did I say Rhode Island?
Not yet.
Rhode Island. Okay. Rhode Island and Vermont.
All states that when I picture in my head, I always think of like a Norman Rockwell painting. So my grandma used to have like these Norman Rockwell paintings on the wall. And I don't know how my association with these specific states, somehow I picture this like idyllic childhood where kids are just, you know, riding their bikes and dads are coming home from work. Mom's got, it's like a 1950s painting. That's exactly what I picture.
I mean, a lot of it does feel like it's behind a little bit. So you're definitely right there. And then I will say that like growing up here, I grew up on a very tiny road where it was pretty much me and my cousins and our grandparents on the road. And there was maybe only like three other houses. And so we pretty much had the rule of the road. So we would, you know, run all around, going into people's houses, doing whatever we wanted because everybody knew each other. So it definitely, you are not wrong in that part of it. Like it's very much a small town. Everybody knows each other, which has its perks and its downsides.
You grew up on Elm Street, right?
I grew up close to Elm Street.
I remember you saying that in one of your episodes that you would watch horror movies and then being like, you know, close to Elm Street or your friend's house or your house or whatever. And I'm like, ooh, that would be terrifying when you're watching Nightmare on Elm Street and you live near Elm Street.
Elm Street is actually two streets away from where I grew up.
So what got you started podcasting? Because I was just telling you yesterday, I listened to your first episodes and we're going to talk about the case of, well, multiple cases. There's three different women that we know of who are victims of James Rodney Hicks. And this is a hometown serial killer for you. But it's very clear from your first episodes that you're a really good storyteller. The production value is excellent. And it seems like you're just a professional right from the jump. And there's not very many people who can kind of come at it in their very first episode and sound so professional. So what's your secret?
Well, I was on another show for a little bit, but that was more like casual. It was a two-person show. So I did have a little bit experience coming into it. However, I had no knowledge of mics, of general production, of putting up an episode. I never edited an episode before. But like, I do have experience writing. And I guess by craft, I am a professional storyteller because I'm an actor. So like, storytelling just comes naturally to me. Like, that's kind of where I thrive. So I ended up buying a course so that I could learn how to do technical stuff and just kind of really have a roadmap of where to go. And that I kind of followed that and just, I knew what I wanted to do. And I just really like honed in on that niche and started crafting the show.
What I found really impressive was your ability to reach out to local law enforcement, to reach out to the family members related to the victims. And you've put the story together based on interviews, based on these one-on-one type things. Like, there's one point in the story, James Rodney Hicks, where you're talking about the reporter who you know from the Bangor Daily News. I can't remember her name.
And how Renee Ordway?
Yeah. And how you like talked about true crime over wine on the porch. And I'm like, just the way you described it, it all sounds so picturesque and I can picture it in my head. And I think that's one of the things about your storytelling that sets you apart from so many other podcasters is it's incredibly immersive.
Thank you. Thank you so much. In film, they say when you're writing a script to like write what you know. So in a way, it kind of is fitting that I'm kind of pulling from stuff that's all around me. You know, like I'm able to describe these tiny towns because I know where they are. And I find that a lot of other podcasts that cover, well, first of all, Maine doesn't ever make podcasts. It's very rare that unless it's focused on Maine or New England, that a Maine story will make a podcast. So first of all, there's that. But second of all, I find that people don't really, because like, I don't know what it's like living in Kentucky or living in, you know, Idaho. So I find that the geography really helps to like, I don't know. I really want to make people feel like they're there and that they can like kind of immerse themselves in the story.
You do a really excellent job with that because when I walk away from one of your stories, it feels like I was there. And that's a really hard thing to do because most of the time I know personally when I would come at a story, I don't have that background knowledge of that place. When I've been to a place, it does feel a lot easier and more authentic in telling a story. Otherwise, it's like, let me look up what this place is like on Wikipedia so I can then describe it, right? Like there's a population of such and such, and this is their main industry and whatever. And it's just, there's something about actually experiencing it that makes it so much different. It just totally hits different.
For sure. And also where I do try to include a lot of the families of the victims, I try to get their area from their perspective as well to kind of set the listener into the story to care about the victim that I'm talking about and just really include the family's perspective in telling their loved one's story. So I think that that also really helps because a lot of the places I haven't been to, but I know where they are geographically, which helps too.
Yeah, I love how you always include, well, whenever you can, you include law enforcement and you include the family members because I think having that personal connection to the victim, it makes them not just a statistic or just, you know, another number of a killer. It makes them a fleshed out human being who was loved by so many people. And I think that is so poignant and it's something that is rarely done in most podcasts, but it's something you do beautifully.
Yeah, that is something that I try to strive for. And also like these cases are, you know, on a big scale of true crime, these are very small cases. And by small, I don't mean that they're any less impactful. It's just that there's no coverage on them at all. Like there is no Wikipedia page that I can go to. A lot of the times there isn't even newspaper coverage in all of the archives that I use. So some of them I really have to dig to try to find any kind of local coverage on them. So I need the families to want to tell their story if they want this to get out there to, you know, help the cases, especially in the cold cases, because a lot of the times people don't know the cold cases that are around them. They don't know that history. So helping get these stories out there, I think it's very important to have the family's perspective, because I do want to make the victims a real person, and I want the listener to care about them and want them to get justice. But, you know, also I need that as a resource, because I just don't have a Wikipedia page to be able to use, or newspaper coverage like, you know, JonBenet Ramsey or a case like that.
So I want to segue right into your hometown serial killer case. And that was James Rodney Hicks, which you refer to him as James or Jimmy Hicks throughout the episode. And I always think it's funny how so many serial killers and presidents seem to go by three names.
It's very true.
So let's talk about James Hicks' first victim. And this is sort of what kicked off law enforcement being aware of James Hicks as a potential murderer. So do you want to talk a little bit about Geralyn Towers?
Yeah. So technically, Geralyn Towers is his second victim, but they didn't know that at the time. This case, side note, this case blows my mind. It just blows my mind. And I don't understand how people don't know about this case, because it's so wild. I mean, it's like a Lifetime movie. It's so crazy to me. But anyway, Geralyn Towers. So in 1982, on October 16th, she went out to the bowling alley with her family. She has a daughter and with her dad. And on the way back, she had her dad drop her off at the Gateway Lounge, which the Gateway Lounge still exists, except it's not the Gateway Lounge today. It's called China Way, and it's a Chinese restaurant, but it looks exactly the same. It's this giant, gaudy red building in the middle of town, and it's been there longer than I've been alive. So he dropped her off at the Gateway Lounge. She wanted to have a couple drinks before she came home. She said, "I'll call you when I'm ready to come home." And it's only like a 5-minute drive from, you know, where she was living to Gateway. And she never called. So around 1 a.m., a car pulled into the driveway, and Geralyn's family thought, okay, well, that must be her. She must be home safe. And the next morning, they wake up and she's not there. So they call the police, and then the police start asking questions. And in the episode, I interview Jim Ricker, who was the police chief at the time, and he was the one that first investigated this case. And he started asking questions and going down to the Gateway, and they find out that a man named James Rodney Hicks was like buying her drinks all night and flattering her. And the bartender said that they left together, but she said that she didn't see them like physically in the car together. They just left at the same time. But still, he was one of the last people to see her alive. So Jim Ricker goes to his hometown where he was living. He was living in Carmel, which Newport is actually where this takes place. This is my hometown where the Gateway is. And Newport is kind of like the hub. Like, it's where there's a big truck stop. It's right off the interstate. It's where people get gas. It's where the Walmart is. And all these tiny clusters of towns pretty much have to come to Newport to get groceries and stuff like that. So he lived in Carmel, and that's about two towns over. And when he went to ask Hicks some questions, all of a sudden his behavior changed. Like, he was just going there to be like, "Hey, did you see Geralyn? What happened? You know, like, when did she leave?" And he started getting really weird. And Ricker told me that he like dumped a glass of water on his head. He started getting really flustered and sweaty and just erratic. And at one point he said, "You think I killed my wife?" And Ricker was like, "What are you talking about?" But that like struck a chord with him. So when he left, he was like, "All right, I'm going to look into this, because that's weird. I mean, you don't just accuse people of thinking that you killed somebody." So he started digging into it, and come to find out, his first wife, Jenny Sear Hicks, was actually missing. And there was a police report filed, but it didn't really go anywhere, because there was no like proof of foul play or anything like that. She just disappeared. And he said that she ran off with another guy. And I guess in 1977, that's good enough of an answer for the police. You know, like, there's no proof that anything bad happened to her. So they had met in high school and she got pregnant when she was 16 and he was senior. And she ended up dropping out of school. They had a kid. They had another kid. They got married against her family's wishes and they were trying to build a life. But James Hicks is a terrible human being. And so I can just about imagine how difficult that was living with him. And he's cheating and there's money issues and all of that stuff. So on July 19th, 1977, he ended up calling the police and said that Jenny Hicks was missing, his wife. So the family put an ad in the paper, nothing came from it, and the case just fizzled out. And that was it until this moment in 1982 when Ricker goes to investigate another missing persons case, which is Geralyn Towers. So then he started like pulling out the phone book and calling all of the Sears in the phone book, and he got her family. And they immediately break down into tears because they're like, something bad happened to her. Nobody will believe us. So then he started to like dig into this case and knocking on doors. And Jenny and James lived in a trailer park at the time. So the trailer park still existed and they knocked on doors, tried to find people who knew them. And they learned that James Hicks had a live-in and Jenny had a live-in babysitter named Susan. And she was actually the last person to see Jenny alive or not alive. She was the last person to see Jenny alive, period, other than James Hicks. And Susan said that Jenny was planning on leaving James. And there was one night where in July, she went out on a date, Susan did, and she returned around 4 a.m. And James was sitting in the living room with the TV on static. And Jenny was just lying on the couch, but like in a really unnatural position. Like her head was kind of flopped over close to the floor. Her hair was covering her face. And he didn't really say anything about her. And, you know, Susan's only 15. So that's terrifying. And the next day when Susan woke up, Jenny was gone. And that was it.
And with Susan, so leading up to Jenny wanting to leave, like Susan basically was, she was in like child and family services custody or whatever, right? And then she made an arrangement with Jenny and with James, like or her custody worker or whatever did, so that she would basically be the babysitter for the family. And then they would take care of her, like because they had the two young children at the time. And so at one point, I guess James had been like hitting on her. But then I remember you talked about in the episode that he pressed himself up against her and was like trying to have sex with her, but she resisted and kind of fought him off. And I guess that might have been the catalyst for Jenny being like, okay, like this is finally enough. You're trying to sexually assault the babysitter. There's been all of this infidelity. And, you know, one of the things that hit me really hard in the episode, trigger warning for animal abuse. Okay, so this is even hard for me to say because anything regarding animals, I'm like you, Kristen. I love animals. So James tells a story about giving away his dog to somebody and then running over the dog as he leaves. And then another time, whose cat did he say that he killed? Was it Jenny's?
I think it was Jenny's sister. Yeah, I don't even know if I want to say what he did, but it just, the cat was alive and he killed it.
Yeah, we don't need to say it because it's going to upset people, but it was horrible. This is somebody that's got no regard for animals or human beings. And later in life, his adult children, like when they become adults, come forward and say that there was sexual abuse by Jimmy Hicks. So every horrible thing that you think that a human being is capable of, that's this man.
Yeah. And it's so funny because I did talk to some people that knew him like in high school and just around town. And it's kind of one of those things where like behind the scenes, you have the people who are closest to him are noticing this behavior. Like he's controlling, he's abusive, he hurts animals, he probably hurts his wife. But yet like the public, he's Mr. Nice Guy. He was a track star in high school. He's very handsome. Like I have a photo of his high school yearbook photo on my Instagram, and he's very handsome and very unassuming. And people said that like he was very polite around town, you know, like just come into the store, he would be just very nondescript. And you just wouldn't expect that. But then the people who are, you know, closest to him are getting the brunt of his true colors.
I think that the way he came off to men was entirely different than the way he came off to women. And like one thing that really stuck with me is almost how he targeted Jenny. Like you spoke about her being this like quiet ninth grader. She was 14 years old. And Jimmy had said to one of his friends, like, I'm going to marry that girl. And it was also said that like what Jimmy wanted, Jimmy got. Like he had an incredible amount of focus and somehow he exhibited this control over all of these women and he was able to manipulate them. And like when people would describe him, it was so different because it was like the women in his life saw this markedly different side of him. But then all of these men who are describing him had a different impression, the type of prisoner he was. Well, of course he was that type of prisoner. He's not dealing with women. And maybe when it comes to men, he's more of a coward. And that's what we saw when he eventually goes to prison in Texas and he really, really wants out.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that he really targeted a very specific kind of woman too. Like the kind that, you know, Jenny was shy. Maybe she hadn't had, you know, attention from boys before in school. And, you know, you have this older guy who's very charismatic and very handsome and giving you attention. And, you know, with like Geraldine, he didn't have a relationship with Geraldine. He only met her that night. But Geraldine went to the bar to meet somebody. You know, like she was a regular at the bar and she had issues with alcohol. So he targeted her for a reason. She was an easy target because she wanted attention. So, you know, he's showering her with booze and with attention. And it just manipulates her to get what he wants.
And I think her brother described her as like a hopeless or hapless alcoholic or something like that. And she'd only just gotten out of the hospital the day before going to the Gateway Lounge and then meeting this fate with Jimmy Hicks. But she seems almost like the wild card because his other victims seem to be women that were really close to him. It doesn't seem to be this like impulsive killing thing. But again, like later on, we won't talk about it yet, but this other victim of his who survives, June, she sees like this impulsive anger and rage that comes from Jimmy Hicks. So it's, I guess he's not just one type of killer. He presents in different ways.
Yeah, I think Geraldine was an incident where he snapped. I think there was an argument that happened and he just snapped. But, you know, Jenny was very calculated as far as like she was going to leave him. So he took care of the problem.
So do you want to describe what led up to Jimmy Hicks being arrested for what is a historic case in Maine? Because it's a no-body case, right? Entirely built on circumstantial evidence. But the state decides to try Jimmy Hicks for the murder of Jenny Sear.
Yeah. So basically this account from Susan is their strongest account because nobody else had really seen anything. So they decided to take their chance on that. And they had enough circumstantial evidence to arrest him. And they did. And they charged him with murder. They can't do anything about Geraldine because they don't have any proof of that. But they arrested him with the murder of Jenny Sear. And they didn't have a body. They didn't have any physical evidence, no proof of foul play other than that account. So they were really, really hoping that their star witness was going to pull through for them because they have other, you know, witnesses that come up on the stand, but nothing like hers. You know, she saw Jenny dead on the couch and they hoped that that was enough for the jury to, you know, want to convict him.
I thought it was incredible that they managed to get a conviction. Unfortunately, he was a free man for quite a while before he ended up actually going to jail and serving his sentence, which ended up only being 7 years, correct? Like he got out on good behavior.
Yep. He was sentenced to 10, but then he got out in 7.
And while he was in jail, he had a girlfriend named, it was Linda, right?
Yep. Linda Markey.
And Linda was really great because she was looking after all the kids, correct?
Yes. So she had her own kids from a previous marriage. And then she was also taking care of Jenny's kids too. And I think they had a kid together. I could be wrong on that. I can't quite remember.
I think they did too, but I'm not 100% either.
Yeah.
But I thought
she had like five kids she was taking care of.
Yeah. Linda's kind of a rock star because, you know, she later goes on to want to start a support group for people who've been affected by Jimi Hicks, which I think is really pointed. And she writes that letter that you talk about. It's a strange letter. I think you describe it as bizarre that she wants to start a support group for all of those who've been affected by Jimi Hicks. But if you imagine all of the women whose lives he's touched, she's one of the few who got out lucky. Like, they get married, but first there's some difficulty because, funnily enough, like, I find this to be the funniest part of the story, that the state tries him for murder successfully, the murder of Jenny Seer, yet they will not on paper declare that Jenny Seer is deceased. So he's technically still married to somebody that he's convicted of murdering.
Yeah.
And so he doesn't have the financial resources to get a divorce. So him and Linda have some difficulty there from the jump. And then eventually they resolve that. They get married and it's this somber ceremony. But she divorces him before he gets out of jail. And you say that you think that's what saved her life. I agree. Do you want to talk a little more about that?
Yeah. I mean, so far, the pattern as far as like who he's killed other than Geralyn has been people who want to leave him. So I think that because she was able to, you know, get away in time. But for, I mean, before even all that, it just baffles me that she wanted to marry him even still. Like they went through a big battle to even get that marriage license. And she still married him, even though he was convicted of killing his wife. But I do think that that saved her in a way, because if he had been out of jail, there is a potential that she could have been his next victim. And I also think that support group is really funny. It kind of reminds me of Mean Girls. Like, raise your hand if you've been personally victimized by Regina George.
That's totally what it reminded me of, too. That's exactly where my mind went when... I thought about her being like, we should all start a support group. And I'm sure what she endured was absolutely awful, because Jimi Hicks is a terrible, terrible person. And he spreads nothing but like unhappiness wherever he goes. So I'm sure she was very deeply affected by the things that he did, most of which I'm sure we don't know. But the fact that she wanted to start a support group is really funny. But unfortunately, most of the women that probably would have joined are deceased.
Yeah, for sure. So he ended up getting out of jail in July of 1990, after serving 7 years. He was a model prisoner and he got off on good behavior, which I understand, but I also have conflicting thoughts over because like I think he's one of those people that knows how to fit in, like kind of like a Dexter in a way, where he knows that he has to be calm in public. He has to be friendly and, you know, peaceful and well presented. Otherwise, it's so much easier for people to point fingers at him.
He's like a chameleon or a mimic. I would say that he exhibits plenty of hallmarks of psychopathy, but when described by, what was the former police chief's name that spoke to him when he dumped that water over his head?
Jim Ricker.
Jim Ricker. So when Jim Ricker describes him, he's so nervous, which seems to be almost counterintuitive when you think of, you know, most criminals who exhibit many traits of psychopathy is they're very, very calm in these situations that would be incredibly anxiety provoking for most people. And I'm sorry, like pouring a glass of water over your head, like that's just straight up bizarre. Like that part of the story, I'm like, how did that actually happen?
It's so weird.
It's like, I didn't kill my wife. You're here to accuse me of killing my wife. And it's like, the dude doth protest too much. Nobody even brought that up. No one even said it. And you're denying it. It's really weird.
Yeah, honestly, if he hadn't have said that, I don't even know if he would have. He probably would have gotten away with Geralyn Towers and with Jenny, at least for a little bit longer. Like, they wouldn't have looked into that at all.
So when James Hicks gets out of jail, he gets a job as like a maintenance guy, right?
Yeah. So he lived in Etna for a little bit longer, which Etna is the town that's in between Newport, where Geralyn Towers went missing, and Carmel, where Jenny went missing. It's just another teeny tiny town. And his mother had a farmhouse there. So that's where he's from. And he, for obvious reasons, people were not fans of his. So I think he found it very difficult to live in a small town where everybody knows that you killed your wife. So he ended up moving to Brewer, which Bangor Brewer is like 30-ish minutes from here. And by comparison, it's a city. You know, it's technically a city. There's probably like 30,000 people that live in Bangor now in 2021. But, you know, it's not like New York City or anything by any means. But in comparison to the very tiny farmland that is this cluster of towns, it's definitely a city. So he started working at a motel in like the mid-90s. It's called the Twin City Motel. And he worked there as a maintenance worker. And he started dating another woman named Lynn Ouellette. And she also worked at Twin City Motel. I think she was like a manager or something. I could be wrong on that. And in the spring of 1996, he went into the police department to answer a question about Geralyn. They were still investigating it. It had been, you know, 15, 16 years, like in that area at this point. And no, wait. Yeah, 14 years. It was 14 years at this point. And he went in to answer some questions about Geralyn. And they know that he did it, but they just don't. There's nothing that they can do. And Lynn went with them. And so the detective, I think it was Zamboni, and I think he might have worked for the sheriff's office at that time, but he also worked for the state later on as the state police. He was asking Hicks questions in a way that would kind of clue Lynn in on his past, just in case she didn't know about Jenny and about, you know, Geralyn's disappearance. So that was in May of 1996. And a few days after that incident, on May 26th, James Hicks calls up the police department and reports Lynn Ouellette missing.
This is just like, are you kidding me? And you say in the episode, like Occam's razor, you know, the simplest explanation is typically the correct one. The only women that are going missing in Maine are ones that are involved with James Hicks.
Absolutely. Like, you're not the only person to be, you're not the person that's like last seen with three women who have disappeared and have that just be a coincidence. Like, it just doesn't work like that.
No, like, it just doesn't happen. And it's like, after Lynn is given this information, and one detail I really liked about Lynn is that she's a really gifted artist. She was accepted into Disney's cartoon school, which I thought was a really cool detail, but she didn't end up going because she wanted to get married and have some kids. And I think she was married like two times before and then divorced. And one of her family members had said that she always picked guys that wanted to protect her. And I don't know if that's like code for guys that are controlling, because Jimmy Hicks seems certainly like a really controlling man.
Absolutely. I don't know if she ended up having kids. I don't think she did, but, I think that she just had like a very independent spirit. So she needed a particular kind of man. And unfortunately, she just got hooked up with Jimmy Hicks.
Which seems to be a death sentence for so many women. Like, it's so fortunate that he ended up having that talk with Ricker, right? Where he did all those bizarre things, because had he not exhibited that behavior, he may have still been out there and had like, you know, six victims or seven victims.
Yeah, I mean, it's really an insert foot in mouth moment where you caused your own demise for crimes that you possibly could have gotten away with. You know, not that we want him to get away with it. We want him to insert his foot in his mouth, but it's just funny to me.
And during all this time, law enforcement still never searched Jimmy Hicks' property, correct?
It's not clear to me. I don't think they did. They might have just a little bit, but they didn't have any proof that Geralyn, you know, went there. So they couldn't get a search warrant for the property. I know that they did do some searches. I'm not sure where in the timeline that fits, but I don't know if they ever like got a search warrant prior to 2000 on Geralyn Towers. I don't think that anything was done like that.
So Lynn goes missing, like, oh no, like the second woman that I'm involved with is missing. First my wife, and then I guess, well, Geraldine is also missing, but they couldn't prove anything. Like nobody was like, the last place she was seen was at Jimmy Hicks' home. So that was a little bit harder to tie him to at that point. But it's like, okay, second woman is now missing. He's already been convicted of Jenny Sears' murder. This is looking really sketchy. Now he gets involved with another woman, an 18-year-old, which is inappropriately young, given the fact he's like 42 or 43.
Yeah, she was 18. He was 43 years old, and she was pregnant, which I have no words for. I mean, it's just, it's awful. And then you think this poor girl, she has no idea what she's getting into.
And the state then takes away their baby because obviously Jimmy Hicks's history, and I think they speak to the children, like his now adult or grown children, and they allege sexual abuse by their father. So what does the couple do? They decide to move to Texas.
Yep. I think that James was kind of feeling the pressure here. I think that he was kind of, you know, I'm under a microscope right now, and I want to be able to keep my kids. And he thought that the answer was moving to Texas. So they did. I think it was around 1998 or 1999 where this happened. They moved to Lubbock, Texas.
And she had another baby. And they thought, oh, perfect. We're going to get to keep this. And I think it was a son. And Texas was talking to Maine. And Maine was like, I think you might want to take this baby away. This isn't going to be a healthy environment.
Yeah. So their baby got taken away too, which thank goodness, because it's just not a good situation for kids to live in. And Brandy and James got married. And she just, you know, she doesn't believe all the lies about him being a killer and he was railroaded at the trial and all of these lies that he's feeding her. You know, she's 18, she's a kid, and she's believing them.
Yeah. And the power dynamic between somebody who we don't know what age they were when, you know, maybe she was 17 when they met.
Exactly.
We don't know if he groomed her from when she was younger and then they just announced their relationship when she was 18. So we can't be sure of those details. And I think the amount of coercive control somebody can have and the amount of manipulation and indoctrination is almost catastrophic, right? You can basically turn that young woman into whatever you want her to be. And I think that speaks to what you said earlier, that he very carefully chose the women he was with. And it was women that maybe were more quiet or he thought were easier to manipulate or push around.
Absolutely. And also, I don't think that people were really paying as much attention to like, oh, she's 17 and he's 43, because they're kind of keeping their relationship and just their lives in general on the down low because he doesn't want to be out in the public. So at the same time, there's that. But yeah, I mean, I definitely feel like she was manipulated. Like, it's really easy to point a finger and be like, wow, you're really dumb. But like, I really think that she was manipulated by this grown ass man who knows how to get what he wants from women who are vulnerable.
Yeah, I think she's blameless in the situation. It's very easy to, you know, point the finger at her and go, she must have known. But she was basically a kid when they got together. We don't know what age he met her and all those sorts of things. I just think it's very convenient that they announced this relationship when she's 18. I mean, maybe they did meet when she was 18, but we'll never truly know for sure. And I think when he gets them young like that, he obviously has a habit of being able to mold them into what he needs them to be. And they are very much in denial. Like, I think we had Linda say something really similar where she was like, I just need proof, or I've got a really good feeling that she's still alive. You know what I mean? That that he didn't do it and I need to have proof. And it's because he's denied, denied, denied. But one thing that really stuck with me was the bloody mattress that he insisted on sleeping on. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So when I was talking to Ricker, he told me this, and I don't know if it was, I assume that it was Linda that he was talking about, but throughout the course of, you know, the years that they were investigating him and keeping tabs on him, apparently there was this mattress that had blood on it, and he made him and his wife sleep on it, like on the floor. And it's just, and I don't know whose blood it was, but it's just so bizarre. And it makes me wonder what other things like that happened in their relationship that like we'll never know about.
Yeah, it's just so gross. It's like you hear of serial killers keeping trophies and you have to wonder, why does one want to keep a bloody mattress? Is this like his version of a trophy?
Yeah, and I'm not sure. Well, I guess I could guess why, what, where the blood came from. But yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's weird. It's weird. It's like time to throw the mattress out, but there's a reason why he's keeping it. And there's a reason why he's making his current wife sleep on it. And it's probably not her blood.
That brings me to, we'll talk about it in a bit, but the head in the concrete block.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, okay. Next, we have like all of this happening. Everything seems to be pretty quiet. Like Jimmy Hicks seems to be just living this chill life with Brandy and doesn't seem to be making waves until he starts doing work on June's home. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So he was living in Lubbock, Texas, and he was doing handyman work and just kind of like, I guess, technically freelancing at the time. And he was working for a woman. She was 67 years old and her name is June Moss. And on April 8th, I think he'd been working for her for quite a while. Like he was really laying low. And on April 8th, however, everything kind of changed. This is 2000. His behavior was really odd when he showed up one day to do some work on her house and he wanted to like drink on the job. And she didn't, obviously, she's like, I'm paying you. I also don't want alcohol in my house. So she didn't like that. And he was just super aggressive with her. And he would just point out like, oh, that's expensive. This thing is expensive over here. Pointing things out in her house that were really expensive and just being a little bit erratic. Again, erratic. And she started to get a little bit nervous when she tried to reach for the phone. You know, he tossed it out of her hand and pulled the cord out and disconnected it. Because, you know, like people don't have cell phones in 2000. I mean, maybe some do, but most people don't. So he disconnected the phone, which was, you know, attached to a cord, and trapped her in a room and pulled out a gun. And he's just waving it wildly in the air. He's drinking a beer. He's ranting about all of his issues in life. Like, you know, oh, everyone thinks that I killed my wife and I can't get my kids. Like, they won't let me keep my kids. And just like getting more and more worked up. And he said that he wanted money from her and he made her write what she thought was a suicide note to her kids. So in the back of her mind, she's like, okay, I have to stay calm. I have to not let him see my fear. You know, I hope that this isn't the last moment that I see, you know, that I'm like writing my kids this note. That's not the truth. I hope that this isn't my last moment and I can see them again, but like I have to remain calm to survive this. So then he pulls out a bag with a bottle of Diet Coke, but it's not Diet Coke. It's cherry cough syrup. And he forced her to drink it. And she got through about half the bottle before she started vomiting. And then he went in the other room and started drawing bath water. So in her house, there's wind chimes at the back, at one of like the back doors. I think it was on the closet door to where the guns were, because he wanted to try to find more guns for some reason. So she was trying to drink down this cough syrup and, you know, also just survive this awful situation. And she hears the wind chimes and she knows that he's on the opposite side of the house. So she's like, this is my chance. I have to like try to make a break for it. So she ran out the door, ran over to the neighbors for help. And, you know, he obviously took off running once he realized that she wasn't there and tried to escape the situation, but she lived. She survived. She survived an encounter with Jimmy Hicks.
I love how she just quietly escaped. Like the latch didn't make any noise. She like quietly opens the door, runs over to the neighbor's home and the grandson and the neighbor are there. And then they chase after Jimmy Hicks. And like, he's tearing up the note as he's driving this like suicide note, mm-hmm. which she signed, like, I think June E. Moss rather than mom, hoping her kids would remember, like, hoping her kids would know that she would never sign a note like that. And then they watch him dispose of the guns. So like everybody's on to you at this point, Jimmy Hicks. And you'd think that he would go into hiding, but he doesn't.
Yeah. Unfortunately, June had, I mean, luckily first, she survived. But, you know, unfortunately, she had to be traumatized for this to happen. But like, this is kind of the moment that they've been waiting for him to slip up and do something, because since, and like get caught for it, you know, definitively slip up and have a finger be pointed at him for a crime. And, you know, it's just unfortunate that you had to traumatize this old woman for it. But on the other hand, you know, this is it. They can work with this. So he was arrested for aggravated assault and robbery against an elderly person, which in Texas is a very serious crime. And especially because of his felon status, you know, he's facing like life. Like he will be in Texas jail for life. So it's like 99 years or something like that.
Yeah, you said 99 years. And like somebody said, like, oh, he picked the wrong state. But before he even got caught for that, I found it so chilling when you described how Jimmy Hicks not like didn't behave like a normal human. He basically goes and leaves a sticky note on June Moss's door and says, I need my tools back. And then goes and knocks on her door another time. Her daughter's like, I don't recognize the guy on the other side of the door. Her daughter has a gun in her hand. And then June peeks through and it's Jimmy Hicks. Like, I mean, the cojones on this guy that he's going to go return to the scene of the crime and be like, I left my tools. Can I please have them back?
Yeah, right. And then just expect that nothing's going to happen. You know,
it's shocking. So what happens when he finally gets arrested for this?
So he finally gets arrested and, you know, they're able to like serve a serious crime at him. And so he ended up going to jail for like a couple of weeks, just, you know, while he was holding for different trials and hearings and all that stuff. And about 2 weeks after, he was like, oh, I don't really like jail in Texas. This isn't fun. Everyone's scary. So he started to talk to authorities in Maine and they were like, well, you know, you can come up here, but you know what you got to do. And basically he worked out a deal where he could serve his sentence in Maine if he told them where all three bodies were and cooperated. That was the deal. He had to tell them where the bodies were, all of them. So, you know, he was like, all right, fine. I'll tell you where the bodies were. So he ended up confessing to Lynn Ouellette, I think in Texas, when they went down, because they were like, we're not going to waste our time bringing you up here for you not to cooperate. So, you know, we need something. So he confessed to killing Lynn Ouellette in Texas. He strangled her in the apartment that they shared because she told him that she was leaving him, which, you know, I guess he just doesn't want to have to deal with a breakup like a normal person. So he killed her.
Like at this point, these two don't even have a good relationship. Like they hadn't been intimate in like a year. He forced himself into like this living situation with her that she clearly didn't want to be in. And is like, you know, just trying to almost infiltrate her family, trying to like do things with her mother and stuff. And she's like, what's going on? This wasn't like this wonderful relationship that she was walking away from. But it's like Jimmy Hicks just could not take rejection.
Yeah, I think he made a lot of people uncomfortable with his energy, for sure. The weirdest part about this to me is that he kept her body in a box in the maintenance room at the hotel or the motel that they both worked at before he ended up dismembering her, putting her in cement blocks, and then dumping her up in the Haynesville woods. So if you look at Maine, like the top half of the state, that's kind of like that triangle-ish point, is all forest. I mean, it is very, very thick wilderness, remote. There's like one road pretty much that goes up there. But it's like, it's kind of the perfect place to hide a body. There's a song about it, about the Haynesville woods, just about how many bodies are up there. It's kind of weird.
Because it's dangerous, right? Like if a lot of truckers have died on that road, and you said it's one of the most haunted places in Maine.
It is. Yeah. There it's Route 2A up in Aroostook County. And the song is about this stretch of road where there's a curve and it's just very like treacherous to drive. So there have been a lot of accidents and a lot of deaths. And I also imagine that there's just a lot of people hidden up there as well. Like, it's just one of those places where, like, if you know where you're going and what you're doing, it's you can get away with it, unfortunately.
That's such an awful thought. Like, ugh. That song is really creepy, too.
It is.
The words to it, I was like, ugh, don't like that.
And it's, like, all upbeat, too. Like, if you listen to the actual song, I can't remember what's it called. Like, what
a
is that
body for
called?
Every mile or something.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yep. It's a weird song. So they ended up finding Lynn's remains. They were in a cement filled buckets and just dumped up in the woods. They weren't buried. They were just up there. And he also ended up taking them to where I think it took a little bit of like persuasion, because at that point he'd only confessed to Lynn. He didn't confess to anyone else, but he knew, you know, they kept pushing like, hey, we need more or we're going to send you back to Texas. And everyone's going to be really pissed because you wasted a lot of money and time. So he ended up taking them to where Geralyn was buried. So finally they're starting to get some closure. And she was buried in his mother's backyard underneath a chicken coop. And she was also dismembered, but she was the only one who was buried mostly in one place.
Wasn't Jenny like under the apple tree? And both of them were like 6 inches under the ground or something. Like, he didn't even bother to dig a proper grave.
Yep. Very shallow graves. He said that he and Geralyn had gotten into an argument that night and he spontaneously strangled her in his car. And there was one thing that I read that it was down to the swim front. Like, as you're going, there's like a little like drive off area where you can kind of like look at the lake. And I think that might be where it was, but I'm not 100% sure. But he strangled her in his car and then ended up, you know, burying her in a shallow grave in the chicken coop, which is just awful.
Oh, yeah. He just disposed of these women like garbage. He didn't even bother to dig a proper grave. And like, one thing I thought was not funny, but I thought it was like, this is how much the families hate him and how much they want him to suffer, is originally two of the three families of Geralyn, Jenny, and Lynn had said that they didn't want Jimmy to leave Texas. They would trade, knowing where their loved ones were, to keep him in a place that he hated. That's how much they wanted Jimmy Hicks to suffer. And I think in speaking to families, most of the time they just want to have a resolution and know where their loved one is. But I think that he's just such an evil man that they wanted to see him punished for what he did. And knowing that he really hated it in Texas was almost like, you know, resolution enough.
Yeah, like in a way, that's really the only card that they have left, even if they, you know, can't really play it. But just because in a way that like him coming to Maine, he is ultimately getting what he wants out of, a not ideal situation for him, but he's still getting what he wants. He doesn't want to be in Texas because Texas is hard. And it's not like Maine, you know, like I obviously don't know what it's like inside the Maine prison system, but just from what I've heard that if you're going to be serving life, you'd rather do it in Maine. Like Texas prisons are much more severe and there's a lot more people. And I think the treatment in general in Maine is a little bit better. So, you know, he's ultimately getting what he wants out of the situation.
And he also tried to kill a senior citizen, like a vulnerable old lady. So it was brought up in your episode that yes, wouldn't go over too well in the prison there. So I'm sure that James Hicks was not exactly on the top of the hierarchy of criminals. And I'm sure that he was reminded of that every day.
Yeah, I think he would have been an easy target because it's kind of one of those things where like, even in the prison system, people don't like child molesters. They don't like people who hurt old people. So you're already coming into a really tough system with like bad marks on your back.
Exactly. It's like if you're somebody that's going to hurt children or you hurt animals, you hurt the elderly, even most criminals can draw a line there and understand that that is just something that you don't do. Right. Like, whereas somebody that, you know, kills their partner, kills a woman, they're like, oh, we can understand that, but we can't understand somebody who hurts a kid, which is strange. But I guess I understand where they're coming from. It's like complete innocence. You know, a child or like an elderly person, someone who's so, so vulnerable. And yeah, I think Jimmy Hicks obviously didn't have a good time. So they at least can cling on to that, knowing that he did spend a good amount of time in Texas and that he probably wasn't treated very well.
Right. And, you know, he's also probably pretty puny in comparison to some of these guys who have probably been in there and, you know, are really bulked up and, you know, their moral standards are kids and old people. So he wouldn't have liked it there.
No, exactly. So once all of these remains are discovered, like what happens with Jimmy Hicks?
So the third remains, I'll talk about Jenny a little bit before I get to that. The third set of remains are the most messed up, in my opinion. Like all of them are messed up, but this one just has that extra layer that really makes him a psychopath in my mind, like this quiet psychopath. And Jenny's remains, the only part of her that was found was her head. So the rest of her remains were scattered throughout Carmel. He said that they did get into an argument that night and she was leaving him and he strangled her with his belt. And so when Susan came home that night, she did see Jenny dead on the couch. And then the next morning she was gone. So he scattered her throughout the woods. So like parts of her will never be recovered. And except for the head, that was the only part that was found. Like you said, it was found under the apple tree, but it was in cement in a cooler. And the messed up part about this is that people from the trailer park remembered seeing James Hicks toting around his little cooler around the park, walking around with it, sitting on it outside, you know, reading a newspaper or something like that. And he also made his kids sit on it like a chair at the table. So in essence, he made his children sit on their mother's head at the dinner table without them knowing. Like the psychological damage that that does, it's just like incomprehensible. It's just so awful.
It's like this man keeps the strangest trophies. Like it is so macabre to hold on to this bloody mattress that he very well, you know, killed somebody on, and then he makes his next partner sleep on it. But the worst, this is the absolute worst, is encasing Jenny's head in concrete and just keeping it and toting it around like a souvenir. It's just awful. And then it's one thing for him to do that, but it's like he gains some sick satisfaction in involving the children. Like, I'm making them sit on their mother's head, like making them do that. Why didn't he choose to sit on it? Why did he make the kids do it? Because he liked it, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, he was obviously getting some sort of satisfaction from the fact that he had this little secret and he could, again, pick vulnerable people. And, you know, who are susceptible to, you know, like they listen to him. It's their dad. They don't have a mom at this point. And, you know, like a kid isn't going to know twice to sit on a cooler versus sitting on a chair. And I think it's just that like satisfaction of having that secret of knowing something that other people don't know. And just the smugness. And like, I can just picture him just being so smug carrying that cooler around. Like everyone thinks that I killed my wife, but they have no idea. Or everybody thinks that Jenny disappeared with a man. Like they believe that narrative and they have no idea that I am carrying her head.
I think he feels like the smartest guy in the room. And like exactly what you said, he's like the cat that ate the canary. Just this amount of smugness, feeling like he got away with something. But nobody who describes Jimmy Hicks says he's the smartest guy in the room. I don't think he's that bright. I think he's just lucky that he got away with what he got away with for so long.
I think so too. Because I didn't see anything about him being like an exceptional student. He was just an exceptional track star. And, you know, he just had this charisma, but I think he was an average student, you know, and he didn't like continue any education or, you know, he wasn't like super street savvy. I mean, I can't argue that anyone in Central Maine is very street savvy, but yeah, I think that he just got lucky. And, you know, I think that he picked people who in a way were, I want to say that like Lynn was probably the most involved with her family. But he definitely isolated Jenny. And then Geralyn was a little bit of an outlier, but, you know, Geralyn was super vulnerable because of her alcoholism. And so, yeah, he knew how to pick people.
And so what happened once he's transferred from Texas back to Maine? How long is he going to serve? Does he serve like, is he just going to be there until he dies? Is it concurrent life sentences?
So he couldn't be tried for Jenny. So he was only tried for Lynn and for Geralyn because, you know, double jeopardy. He'd already been tried for Jenny, even though we didn't have the body at that point. But regardless, he got life. He got a life sentence. And in Maine, there is no parole. So he will live in prison until he dies. And he's still alive. He's sitting, you know, at Thomaston in the state prison, just being that same model prisoner that he was in the 80s. And he'll die there. And my cousin actually worked at the state prison for a while, and he worked in his block. And he said the exact same thing, that like, you know, he's very polite. He's very nice. You know, you wouldn't really know anything different. And he also said that he gets a lot of fan mail, which I think is weird. Like, he didn't specify that it was fan mail, but he said that he gets a lot of mail.
Like, from like, who, right? It would have to be fan mail.
That's what I think. I'm thinking that it's probably like, I don't know, like Chris Watts gets a lot of mail. And I'm like, why?
People think he's hot, which is like the grossest thing I've ever heard. Yeah. Oof.
So it wouldn't surprise me if there are women who are writing to James Hicks who are like, you know, I don't know.
I doubt it's, he's got a lot of kids, but I really doubt it's his children keeping in close contact with him, because he sounded like a terrible father who was potentially sexually abusive. So I wouldn't think that his children would be lining up to have a close relationship with their father, but who knows?
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but my guess would also be that they probably don't have a relationship with him.
Yeah, I don't know what Maine prison is like, because your cousin described what the prison he's like is like on the inside. Is it like a comfortable prison? Do they get good food?
You know, I would have to ask him what that's like. I just know that like from comparison to a place like Texas, like it's not as crowded, just because like the population of Maine is less than the population of Manhattan. Like there's less than 2 million people here. So, and, you know, I don't know how many people are in Texas, but I know that it's obviously a huge state.
It's like a country. It's huge geographically speaking and with their population. It's massive.
Yeah. So I think it is a little bit more comfortable. I don't know to what extent that comfort goes, but, or like, you know, what kind of food they get. But definitely, if you were going to choose, probably Maine is a good place to go for a life sentence.
This was seriously one of the most banana serial killer cases that I'd never heard of until I listened to your podcast. And one thing I did find really interesting was, before they had convicted Jimmy Hicks of the killings of Geralyn and of Lynn, the FBI classified him as a serial killer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They were looking into him, and then they officially classified him as a serial killer, I think right after the thing with June. So I think that Jim Ricker was communicating with the FBI over him, because I think that they were just trying to figure out resources of like, okay, how do we get this guy to slip up? Like, how do we get him to, I don't know, how do we get him in prison? How do we get him to confess? So I think that they were in communication with people who had more power, just to see like what angle they could try to go. Cause like, you know, it wasn't even one of those situations where like, oh, we might be pinning this on an innocent person, so like, we don't want to profile you. It's like, we know this guy is dangerous, and if we don't stop him, if we don't get him to slip up soon or confess or find something, somebody else is going to get killed.
it's one of those cases that I was just like, this is a Lifetime movie. Like you said that in the beginning, and it has so many twists and turns. And he is just one of the most horrible, sadistic people that I think I've ever heard of. And I'm just shocked that you were the first podcast to cover this. Like, and there was, it was on, what was the series, in Buried in the Backyard or something?
Yeah, on Oxygen.
On Oxygen, right? But I mean, there's only so much that you can put into a very short episode. And I think what you did was incredibly detailed and fact-based.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to part one of my conversation with Kristen Seavey from Murder, She Told on serial killer Rodney James Hicks. Next week, we're going to talk about Danielle Bertolini and the Humboldt Five. If you're interested in joining the Patreon, I will link it below. I don't have a Riddle Me That Patreon, but there's a Jules and Ashley Patreon. So if you're interested, it's patreon.com/JulesandAshley. And if you want to reach out and talk about this case or any other case, riddlemethatpod@gmail.com. And I'm very active on Twitter @podcastriddle. So I hope to see you again next week. Stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything.